Hello and welcome to another episode of the Well-Tempered Stenographers Podcast. I am your host, Charles Jang. I am a resident at the Wright State University Emergency Medicine Program. Today we'll be discussing two recent additions to the point-of-care ultrasound literature, which are thematically linked by DVT and PE. How useful is point-of-care ultrasound in the diagnosis of these conditions? The first paper we have is a quick hit entitled Ultrasound Performed by Emergency Physicians for Deep Vein Thrombosis, a Systematic Review by Herks et al., published in the Western Journal of Emergency Medicine. It compares DVT studies performed by emergency physicians, aka EPs, to a gold standard of DVT scans or contrast venograms performed by the radiology department, covering the latest in studies since the last systematic review and meta-analysis was performed in 2012. The authors had pre-planned subgroup analyses to cover attending versus trainee scans, as well as the two-point versus three-point scan debate. As you're likely aware, the ultrasound for DVT relies on compression ultrasound of the deep veins. I typically start by finding the common femoral vein above where the great saphenous vein drains into it, and the vein you're studying should fully compress if you're applying enough pressure to partially deform the pulsatile artery. So you note the compressibility of the common femoral vein, including the great saphenous vein and the popliteal vein under the two-point system, and then you add in the quote-unquote superficial femoral vein for the full three-point scan. You should note that this is a misnomer, and the superficial femoral vein is actually the continuation of the common femoral vein after the deep femoral vein takes off. It is therefore a deep vein, and any thrombosis you find here needs to be treated like a deep vein thrombosis, not a superficial vein thrombosis, and therefore needs to be treated with anticoagulants and not supportive care with NSAIDs. Drilling down into the study itself, the population studied was patients presenting to the ED with signs and symptoms of a DVT. The intervention was EP-performed DVT studies compared to radiology-performed studies. The outcome of interest was the dichotomous question of DVT present or not. The authors ultimately found 15 studies between January 2012 and June 2021 that met their criteria in MBASE and Medline. Looking at all the studies, the pooled sensitivity of EP-performed DVT scans was 90%, with a 95% confidence interval between 82 and 95%, and specificity of 95% with a confidence interval of 91 to 97%. They did find substantial heterogeneity among the results, with an I-squared of 84.04 for sensitivity and 89.90 for specificity. And note that the higher your I-squared score, the worse heterogeneity there is between your studies. Having increased heterogeneity among study results indicates that there is increased variance between these studies, which can lead to decreased confidence in the conclusions you draw from their pooled results. The authors did perform a sensitivity analysis where they analyzed the studies that had lower risk of bias separately, and this did significantly decrease heterogeneity within this group, which does increase the overall confidence in this confidence interval of sensitivity and specificity. Based on the author's pre-planned subgroup analysis, this heterogeneity also decreased when evaluating the effects of trainees versus attendings, suggesting that this was a true effect. To illustrate this a little further, you can imagine one of those force plots from a meta-analysis with those little diamonds representing the confidence intervals, taking a look at, in this case, sensitivity. You might see those little confidence interval diamonds kind of scattered around, indicating higher heterogeneity. But if you separate those out based on a certain factor, it's always better if these are pre-planned. You could have all of the attending ones kind of cluster around a higher level of sensitivity, and the trainee ones cluster around a lower level of sensitivity and decrease the heterogeneity in both groups. Sensitivity of trainee performed scans went down to 77% compared to 93% for attendings, with a specificity of 87 versus 92%. There was a wide variety of trainees that were studied, which ranged from interns to third-year residents, with many of the studies just looking at quote-unquote residents. There was a non-significant improvement in overall test performance when using the three-point versus two-point compression ultrasound, with 92% versus 88% of sensitivity, but a p-value of 0.07. However, when they took a look at attendings who performed three-point versus two-point scans, there was a significant improvement with a p-value of 0.02. The authors conclude that EM attendings can accurately assess for DVTs using point-of-care ultrasound and improve their performance by performing the three-point rather than two-point scan based on multiple studies of at least moderate quality, and I do agree with this assessment. They also feel that more study is needed to assess the effect of different subgroups on DVT study accuracy, and I'm also curious to see what developments might arise from this as well, such as how many scans it takes before a trainee-performed DVT study approaches that of an attendings, or which year of training tends to correspond with this as well. I think the author's conclusions that this is a 90% sensitivity and specificity study are well-founded and can lead us to have confidence in our own DVT studies as long as they are performed by an EM attending or, at the very least, a scan supervised by an EM attending. I will also be interested to see further studies looking at how test characteristics of trainee-performed DVT studies improve throughout residency. Moving on to our next paper, I am quite excited about this one. It is entitled Right Ventricular Bubble Time to Identify Patients with Right Ventricular Dysfunction, written by Cohen et al., published in the Annals of Emergency Medicine. I'm sure you've all had the patient that you're starting empiric heparin on while bundling them off to the scanner with a well score of 12.5 and trying to risk stratify as quickly as possible as submassive based on RV dysfunction, but you just can't get that apical four-chamber or parasternal short axis to come into view, and the patient is too obese or obtunded or dyspneic to move into left lateral decubitus or hold their breath. And what are you to do in that situation? The authors propose a novel technique, which they dub the RV bubble time, to help in this regard. It stands to reason that a struggling right heart will tend to have more stagnant blood that isn't moving forward due to a lack of contractility from the RV, increased resistance from the pulmonary vasculature, or both. The authors took a 10cc saline flush, agitated it for 5 seconds, injected it into a peripheral IV, and measured the time it took for the bubbles to show up in the right ventricle, and measured how long the bubbles lingered in the right ventricle and confirmed they were really gone by recording 3 6-second clips. The really handy part of this was that they did not have to obtain any view than the parasternal long or subxiphoid. Simple enough for interns or certain EM department chairs I could name. In addition, bubble studies have been used for a long time with an excellent safety profile to detect intracardiac shunts and to confirm central line placement. This all makes sense in practice, but how does it hold up in theory? Let's take a look at the study design. The study population is stable ED patients that the treating provider thought needed an echo for whatever reason between January and December of 2021. The study institution has a protocol where ED providers can order comprehensive echocardiograms performed and read by cardiologists. The most common indications are what you'd expect, such as chest pain, abnormal EKGs, dyspnea, stroke sequelae, and syncope. This allowed for a gold standard for the RV bubble time. Basically, if the RV bubble time measured was prolonged and the cardiology performed echo had RV enlargement, RV strain, or depressed RV function, this would be marked as a true positive, and vice versa. So whenever an ultrasound fellow or fellowship-trained attending was available during a scan shift, the treating provider let them know. Crucially, the authors note that the scanning providers were blinded to the patient's presenting history and indication for the comprehensive echo, and then a separate blinded assessor confirmed the RV bubble time based on recorded clips. This convenient sampling picked up 196 out of 2,259 eligible patients in this time frame. Of the 69 patients who had signs of RV dysfunction on cardiology performed echo, 67 of them had a bubble time of greater than 40 seconds, while 2 were false negatives. This works out to a sensitivity of 97%. Of the 127 patients who had no sign of RV dysfunction on cardiology performed echo, 111 had a bubble time of less than 40 seconds, and the other 18 were considered false positives. This works out to a specificity of 87%. if these test characteristics with an area under the curve of 0.96 were not enough, the author's acknowledgement of their study's limitations and mitigation steps made their paper truly excellent. They note that their convenient sampling did pose a risk of introducing bias, but compared the echo indications between their study sample and their target population, which were pretty similar. I think they could have dove a little deeper into a comparison of demographics and comorbid conditions to cement this better, but I don't think it would have affected their results too much. The scanners were ultrasound fellows or fellowship-trained attendings, which may increase the effectiveness of the test. They did note that although the scanners were blinded to the patient's clinical history, they of course could see the patient's heart on ultrasound. They did have a second blinded assessor who confirmed the bubble time with an inter-rater reliability of 99.2% with a confidence interval of 90.93% to 99.39%. They did express concern that the high percentage of white patients of 50.5% would skew their data, but a quick look at the U.S. Census data from 2020 does suggest that this is actually not too far off the U.S. population. To break it down further, they had a white population of 50.5% in their sample, black of 23%, Asian 12.8%, and other races measuring 13.8%. Just as a cursory glance, if you compare it to the U.S. population, in 2020 it was measured to be 75.5% white, 13.6% black or African American, 6.3% of Asian, and 19.1% Latino. Do note that this does add up to greater than 100% because people do mark off more than one race on these census forms. This may limit generalizability outside the U.S., but I actually think it matches the U.S. population pretty well. They do note that roughly one-third of the study sample had signs of RV dysfunction of the comprehensive echo. And a quick reminder that the study population is patients with some cardiac concern and not the general populace. The prevalence does not change the sensitivity or specificity of the test, but it does change your positive and negative predictive values. Patients were all stable, and this does limit applicability to critically ill patients. There are a couple of factors that they noted that have unclear effects. The comprehensive echo just had to be done within 36 hours of the order, and it's hard to know what effect a few hours or even one day's delay might have on the echo results. And I guess that would depend on what indication they were brought in for. I guess if they had some CHF and they got treated with diuresis, that might improve whatever right heart or left heart dysfunction that they might be having on echo. But the authors are not sure of what effect this might have in total. They also note that the parasternal long views and subxiphoid views were not compared in a head-to-head, although I'm not really sure of any physiologic reason one might be superior there to another in this situation. You're just trying to find a view where you can just see the right ventricle. So why is this study important other than picking up submassive pulmonary embolisms? Right heart failure has been shown to be associated with increased morbidity and mortality and has an increased prevalence in a variety of patients that we see all the time that have comorbid conditions such as sepsis, morbid obesity, COPD, and methamphetamine abuse. Patients in this study who had RV dysfunction tend to be older and sicker, with decreased LV ejection fraction, reduced cardiac contractility, increased likelihood of having pericardial effusions, and valvular dysfunction. Ruling in right ventricular dysfunction can be very useful in making decisions regarding fluid resuscitation, diuresis, and the use of vasopressors. There's an excellent lecture series by Dr. Sarah Krager on her ICU EDU website, where she calls the right ventricle the princess ventricle due to it being preload and afterload sensitive. The authors also had their scanners look at RV size as part of their pre-planned analysis. And this is, of course, one that most people are going to know about and have some inkling of how to do, even if the apical 4, I think, is one of the more technically demanding scans. When they had their fellows or fellowship-trained attendings use RV size in comparison to the left in order to look for RV dysfunction, it had a sensitivity of 0.86 and a specificity of 0.80. And so despite its fame, RV size is really better used as a rule-in test for RV dysfunction than a rule-out, given its test characteristics were not as good in the hands of even experienced operators. So when it comes to areas of further study, obviously this does need external validation with larger trials. I do appreciate the authors taking a deeper dive into some of the false positives and false negatives as areas of further study. They say that the two false negatives had prior history of cardiac surgery, and some of the false positives had history of significant valvular disease, and this could be an area of pre-planned subgroup analysis in larger studies that are fully powered to pick up these differences. I'd also be interested to see how well the RV bubble time does in predicting RV dysfunction in critically ill patients. Overall, this is a very well done study looking at a relatively easy to perform measurement with a physiologically plausible mechanism, and I, for one, cannot wait to try it on my next ED shift where I'm evaluating a patient for a possible submassive PE. Thank you all for joining me this week. This has been Charles Jang of the Well-Tempered Sonographers podcast, and as usual, the views expressed on this podcast are my own and do not reflect those of the DoD or the U.S. Air Force. Many thanks to Dr. Chu for taking a look at the paper and providing some peer review feedback. I'll catch you all next time.